This is 9/11 Free Fall.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another episode of 9/11 Freefall. My name is Andy Steele, and I am the host. Tonight, we'll be joined by author and activist Elias Davidson. He'll be sharing some of his research and thoughts on the 9/11 crime. That's coming your way in just a moment.
He's in the lobby, and then fucking the third explosion, the whole lobby collapsed on us.
Was that a secondary explosion?
Yes, it was.
Floor by floor, it started popping out.
It was like, if they had detonated.
Detonated.
They were planning to take down a building. Boom, 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 boom.
We have explosive demolition at not only the Twin Towers, but also Building 7.
For the third time today, it's reminiscent of those pictures we've all seen too much on television before when a building was deliberately destroyed by well-placed dynamite to knock it down.
You want to call your mother or something?
It's just a matter of time. That's all it is. It's a matter of time and the persistence of those who continue to adhere to it and push for it. And that's what we're doing.
Tune in to 9/11 Freefall, a show about 9/11 truth, 9/11 science, and the activists and scholars who are blowing the lid off the crime of the century. You can download episodes at 911freefall.com.
The views expressed on this show by guests and the hosts on issues outside of the 9/11 controlled demolition evidence are the opinions of those individuals alone and do not necessarily reflect those of architects and engineers for 9/11 truth.
Elias Davidson was born in Palestine in 1941. He has lived in Iceland, Germany, France, the U.S., and Switzerland, and has been involved in activism and research on social and global justice, peace, anti-racism, and human rights issues, and is the author of Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, Counterfeiting Evidence. And he will publish The Betrayal of America, Revisiting the 9/11 Evidence this spring. He also wrote a book about the Mumbai attacks in 2008, which is considered India's 9/11. He's got a great wealth of research in him and a lot to say on this topic, and it's awesome to have him here on the show this week. Elias, welcome to 9/11 Freefall.
Thank you very much, Andy. Thank you.
So I want our audience to get to know you better. This is your first time on the show. Tell us more about your life. What would you say got you involved in activism in the first place?
Well, generally, I've been very much moved by injustice or fighting against injustice because my parents were, in fact, were refugees from Nazi Germany. They moved to Palestine because of the persecution of Jews by the Nazi regime. So I'm born under the shadow of the Holocaust. Also, my parents and direct family were not victims. They were not in the concentration camps. So injustice was part of basically of my upbringing. But as I was a youngster, I discovered already when I was about 18 that the Zionist idea of the Jewish state was basically a racist idea. I discovered that when I was myself a member of a Zionist youth movement in France, because basically Zionism is predicated on the idea that Jews cannot live in peace among other nations. I found that principle contrary to my experience in France and contrary to my idea that every human being is basically equal in rights and obligations. So I left the idea of Zionism. I thought Zionism is basically predicated on the existence basically of anti-Semitism, and I understood that these two theories are symbiotic of each other. So this was, my first aha effect in my political development. But I did not pursue that issue at that time. It was not really of concern until 1990, where I was co-founded the Association Iceland-Palestine to work for the rights of the Palestinian people, for their dignity, for their sovereignty, and for their human rights. And I have been also supporting the idea of one democratic state for Jews and Palestinians in my home country. So I'm basically human. I approach all these things from a human rights, from universal human rights perspective. But this was basically, it's a very old, an old part of my work. Before that, I did work in Iceland for Icelandic independence, particularly the encroachment by multinational corporations and the World Bank in Icelandic economy. So I did quite a lot of work at that time, trying to show in Iceland the role of multinational corporations, the World Bank and the IMF. But this was work which I did in the 80s, 70s and 80s. In the 90s, I was particularly involved in opposing the economic sanctions which were imposed by the United Nations on the Iraqi population. It was, of course, couched in different terms. It was said that there were sanctions against Iraq or Saddam Hussein, but basically there were sanctions against the entire economy of the country, meaning against the entire population. And as we know today, 500,000 children died as a result of these sanctions. So I began to work against these sanctions and was interested in the legal basis of these sanctions. And so I applied for and obtained a grant from the Icelandic Red Cross Society to study the relation between economic sanctions and human rights. And the result of that investigation were a number of papers, some of which were published by legal journals in the United States, the UK, and Netherlands. So this was basically my first step into the legal profession, although I have no legal academic degree. And after this happened, 9/11 happened, and I believed, like many people, that it was carried out by Muslim militants, very, very fanatic ones, who wanted to give really a beat to the United States. So this was my belief, and it was a belief which was shared by a lot of people, particularly those who were opposed to U.S. imperialism. So we all believed that story until I got hold of a book by a French journalist by the name of Thierry Messon, who basically showed that the story of 9/11, the official one, was deficient. And it piqued my curiosity. So I began studying the 9/11 issue, and it became basically, I was completely hooked to this investigation, which lasted basically 10 years or more. And I decided to investigate the case as if I were a criminal investigator, asking questions, who, where, when, and how, you know, these basic questions. And it came quite early on that I found no evidence whatsoever that Muslim fanatics carried out that crime. This was, in fact, my first. I, of course, came at that time across information that the buildings, the World Trade Center, were demolished. And I had no doubt about that. So this was not basically an issue which I carried out extensively at that time. Later I did, when I went back on that issue, and I'm willing to share with you my findings regarding the World Trade Center.
Yeah, I know you've written about the World Trade Center and the evidence these buildings were, in fact, demolished. And we've talked about it a lot here on this show. Everybody knows where AE 9/11 Truth stands. What did you find when you did your research into that topic?
Well, some things which I know that many of the researchers on the World Trade Center demolitions concentrate on the explosives. What I found in addition to that were basically things which have not been discussed very widely, including, let me begin a little bit earlier on. What I mean here is basically it begins in May 2001 when President Bush announced to expand the responsibility of FEMA to respond to terrorist attacks. This was a political decision made 4 months before FEMA was for the first time called to examine or to investigate the collapse of the World Trade Center. So in May 2001, Bush expanded the responsibility of FEMA to handle terrorist attacks. Immediately after, he nominated Joe Albo, who was his election campaign director, as chief of FEMA. So he nominated his loyalist, a political loyalist, Mr. Albo, to direct FEMA. When 9/11 happened, Albo immediately nominated Gene Corley to lead the BPAT team to make the first study of the destruction of the World Trade Center. Now, Gene Corley was also a political loyalist. He was a principal investigator of the bombing of the Murrah building in Oklahoma in 1995, which was, by the way, demolished by explosives. So we have here already a story which very few people basically know, that Bush, the President George W. Bush, had already prepared, paved the way for this investigation 4 months before 9/11. Other things which are also not so widely known is the ground shaking which occurred prior to the collapse. And there were quite a few witnesses who said that the ground shook before the buildings collapsed or disintegrated. The second issue which is not well discussed are the existence of the hot pools below the ground zero. And these hot pools remained very hot for weeks or even months after 9/11. And there is, until today, no explanation for the existence of these hot pools. I don't personally have any theory about these hot pools, but I think that their existence, which were testified by many witnesses, is one of the mysteries which I think needs to be examined. And finally, a very important thing about the demise of the World Trade Center is the instant pulverization of the buildings. Now, I don't use in my real writings the word collapse, because I don't think that the buildings at all collapsed. I don't think that the World Trade Center 1 and 2 or the North and South Towers, I don't think they collapsed. I think the right word is to say they disintegrated or they're pulverized in midair. The fact is that there is a lot of evidence that this happens. There is photographic evidence, there is video evidence, and there is evidence, written evidence, testimonies, and whatever. I'm not going to go through all that evidence. However, one thing sticks out of all that. It is the disappearance, complete disappearance of 1,120 people, of which no sign has been found, not even a tooth, not a nail, nothing. Nothing has been found in Ground Zero or in the dust of the buildings of about 1,120 people. And this information is reported in the New York Times 10 years after 9/11. So we have a complete disappearance of 1,120 people, which is an unprecedented event. The fact is that you cannot even incinerate people in a second. There is no way to incinerate people, one person or 1,100 people, within 1 second or 2 seconds. But this happened on 9/11. Question is, what caused the demise of 1,120 people? The instantaneous demise of 1,120 people, this question is completely disregarded by practically everybody. So it is not basically a critique of the 9/11 movement. It is just a mention of one part of the story which has not been investigated properly.
Now, you talk about the Twin Towers. Have you investigated World Trade Center 7 too?
Yes, but in the investigation of World Trade Center 7, I cannot add very much to what is already known. There were a few facts which might be not so known, but basically I think that most of the facts which I have shown, which I have found, have been addressed by some of the researchers. Perhaps one little point I would like to mention. It is the idea that Larry Silverstein was responsible or accomplice to this demolition. I have the problem with that idea, with that theory. I have my opinion, but I cannot prove it. But nobody can disprove it. My theory is that Larry Silverstein was framed to be a fallback boogeyman for the destruction of the World Trade Center 7 and the World Trade Center, the other buildings. This is one of the cover stories which I think the U.S. elite has developed and keeps for a rainy day.
If you wouldn't mind, would you elaborate on that?
There are many things which lead me. I don't know if we would like to discuss it in detail. I'm aware. Let me begin in 1933. 1933, we have the Nazi regime. What did the Nazi regime do? It was to accuse Jews of making the life of the German people miserable. Why did it do it? It did it in order to prevent a socialist upheaving and uprising, because the socialists and the communists in Germany were very strong. So in order to save the German elite, the German upper class, the rich upper class, the Nazis found it's very useful to put all the blame on Jews and incite the population against the Jews so that they will not rise up against the German ruling class. Now, using Jews as the boogeyman has a long history. For the US perpetrators of 9/11, there is nothing better than to prepare the ground for a rainy day to accuse Jews or the so-called Israeli lobby to have perpetrated 9/11. This is the best solution for them if they want to escape the death sentence and to save the U.S. elite. So my idea is that the U.S. elite has for years kept the Jewish card for a rainy day. And one of these cards is to keep and finance and support groups within the 9/11 movement who will shift the blame from the U.S. to the Mossad and to Israel. Now, I am not a friend of Israel. I am an anti-Zionist, have combated Zionism and the State of Israel since I'm young. I don't even recognize the right of Israel of existence, of the state. But I am aware of the history of the Jews. And if I am going by that history, it is a very good history lesson. And I believe that if I were part of the U.S. elite, I would resort to the same tactic, the same strategy as the Nazi regime has done. It makes sense to me. Now, if we're going back to the forensics or to the details, it doesn't make sense that a person who basically knew, who is allegedly has known about the plans of destruction of the World Trade Center, would openly and publicly make an agreement of 99 years to lease these buildings, would make openly and publicly known that he insured the buildings for $3.2 billion against terrorist attacks, that he would publicly and knowingly say to everybody that he did not go to the World Trade Center on the morning of 9/11 because he had a doctor appointment, and that he would say in public TV that he gave the order to demolish World Trade Center 7. I know of no criminal who would incriminate himself in that way. It doesn't make sense to me. So if it doesn't make sense to anybody, please let me know.
Now, I understand we're going to move beyond the World Trade Center today a little bit because you've done extensive research in many areas of September 11th, including on the actual hijackers or supposed hijackers, we were told. And it's funny because I think we don't focus in a lot on that in the 9/11 Truth Movement. It seems like we used to, but now people have developed their own ideas on what they think happened. A lot of people say the towers were demolished and all of that, but the hijackers were on the planes and they don't think twice about it. And there's a debate, and I'm trying to open things up and open these things to debate here. So I want to hear your research on that area of 9/11.
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that 9/11 was a crime. I don't think that anybody would dispute that idea. Or is it? Was it not a crime?
Well, it was absolutely a crime. 3,000 people were murdered. So it definitely was a crime scene.
So if it's a crime, how do people lead with a crime? The criminal investigation begins by trying to find out who was at the scene of the crime. What happened? So one of the first questions I went to investigate is who was in the scene of the crime, on the scene of the crime. Now, the scene of the crime, publicly, are the aircraft. So the first question which interested me is not anything which I was seeing on TV. No, it was just the question, who was on the scene of the crime. Who was in the aircraft? And I was looking for evidence that the 19 people accused of that crime had been on that aircraft. I searched for that information for many months. I could not find a single piece of evidence supporting the claim that these 90 people boarded these aircraft. Now, I had been offering even a financial prize to anybody who would give me such evidence, including a senior journalist of a British newspaper. When I confronted him with that proposition, he ran away because he knew he could not produce that evidence. And in fact, there exists not a piece of evidence of that kind. It is a shameful accusation against innocent people who no court of law has ever found guilty. Nobody has seen them board the aircraft. Their names appear on no authenticated passenger lists, and their bodies were never identified. So we are talking here about a legend, an absolute absurd and shameful lie by the United States government, taken over by all media, by thousands of authors and academics who are still today accusing innocent Muslims of mass murder. Now, for me, this is probably even a more terrible crime that the entire American public has kept silent, whereas 19 Muslims have been shamefully and without any ground accused of mass murder. This is nothing but a racism. You don't accuse innocent people of murder. Nobody does it. And those who are keeping silent about it are themselves accomplices. So for me, either a person provides proof, and proof beyond reasonable doubt, which is the standard of evidence needed in criminal law, or shut up and stop accusing Muslims for that. And by extension, the accusations against Osama bin Laden about 9/11 and Afghanistan are all lies. There is no evidence of any evidence of that kind. So the crime of aggression against Afghanistan was exactly as criminal as the crime of aggression against Iraq. There is no difference. Both are based on terrible lies. Except for the first lie on Afghanistan, it has served to undermine civil liberties in the U.S. It has served to justify massive surveillance. It has justified the war on terror. It has justified that corporations who are doing security work are becoming fat and rich. And even human rights activists in the U.S. do not open their mouth. This is basically an indictment of American society. But there are some people who do speak up, but very few. And I'm a friend of the American people. I don't blame them. They are indoctrinated, but they should wake up. And they should not allow any government, any journalist, any author to accuse innocent Muslims, including those 19 people who have been shamefully accused of that murder.
I can't disagree with anything that you said there. Your sentiments about the American response to September 11th, not just the American government, but the people refusing to look into this event any deeper than what they've been told, I think has been very telling. And I think we have a lot of growing up to do and a lot of introspection to do here in this country. Now, I do have to ask you this, because you mentioned about how there's no evidence that the hijackers were on those planes. Now, the people who don't like what we're talking about here, who listen to this show, may bring up this video that shows the hijackers being screened at Dulles Airport. These were the ones that allegedly hijacked the Flight 77 that went into the Pentagon. Are you aware of that? If so, could you address that?
You're talking about this Dulles Airport video. Well, you see, I'm researching that as a criminal investigator. A criminal investigator will say, okay, you have a video from Dulles, very good, but it's not primary evidence, it's secondary evidence, because evidence would be if there would be a video of the people boarding on the plane and the testimonies of witnesses who saw these people boarding on the plane. Now, a video, which it was taken sometime, regardless where and how, is only a secondary evidence. It is not primary one. The primary evidence has never been produced. There is, as I said, I repeat again, no evidence of any person who has seen these people boarding the plane, no video of the people boarding the plane. Their names don't appear on any authenticated or certified passenger list, and their bodies were never found. Now, in addition to that, in my book, I also bring evidence or information, not evidence, but indices that Hani Anjur, who was allegedly the pilot of this plane, did not even have a ticket. This information appeared in the Washington Post. So what I mean here, people can refer to all kinds of secondary pieces of so-called evidence, but they are completely irrelevant in a criminal setting. People can use it maybe for political propaganda, but for a criminal investigation, they have no value.
Now, you talk about the presumption of innocence, and I love the way that you approached this, because of course this was a crime. You asked me that earlier. Of course it is. We have this presumption of innocence until proven guilty in the United States, and I believe in other countries around the world. That is exactly how we would want to be treated if we were accused of a crime. But because of the chaos of that day, because the crime is mixed in with all of this political intrigue and implications that it's seen as an act of war, so people just sort of let go of those principles and those ideas and just go along and put the investigation and the reaction in the hands of government and military. But again, innocent till proven guilty. You have to start from a place of presuming innocence, and the state has to make the case that somebody is actually guilty of this. So you've talked about this in the sense of the 19 alleged hijackers having their presumption of innocence taken away from them. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, of course. The United States is a party of international treaties, human rights treaties, such as the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights, which basically enshrines the principles of the presumption for innocence. Now, the United States also is obliged under this treaty to ensure the right of life and to ensure that it will investigate cases of mass murder. Now, all these obligations have been violated by United States government. I'm not talking now. I can come back to these legal obligations a little bit further line, but I'd like to come back to this principle of this presumption of innocence. Now, we have journalists. In many journalists in the United States are basically obliged to respect the code of ethics of journalists. And the code of ethics asks journalists to respect the presumption of innocence. Now, there are many codes of ethics, both legal and for journalists, and also academics. And this principle has been violated massively by the U.S. media, who call these people terrorists or mass murderers. Now, I cannot accept that this is done. I understand that on 9/11 or a few days after, people were mixed up and so on, and people said things which they shouldn't say. But when the fog of war has dissipated, it is the absolute necessity to keep to uphold that principle, and that principle is violated every single day until today by masses of journalists and authors. And what I find absolutely revolting is that the 9/11 truth movement has not even talked about this violation of one of the most fundamental human rights. Because if it is acceptable to accuse innocents of mass murder, and if the state, if the authorities even do that, then we have a fascist system. And if people do not speak up when this is occurring, they are paving the way for fascism. There is no other word. I cannot make another conclusion. This is one of the worst failures, not only of the American public, which I say, okay, I can apologize, I can excuse it, but for those who are a little bit more intelligent and more educated and know more, that they should also keep silent is inexcusable. And I call on all those who are fighting for 9/11 truth to speak up and condemn all efforts to malign Muslims and the 19 alleged hikers and Osama bin Laden and Afghanistan to have anything to do with 9/11, unless they can come with proof beyond reasonable doubt, as is necessary in a criminal case. If they cannot do that, they should shut up and not accuse anybody. At least the minimal is not to say anything and to say, I don't know who did it.
Right. And a lot of people don't even really know the official story that they are defending, even people that are in Congress. Now, I focus only on the buildings, but there's so many elements to this entire crime that I'm just thinking of questions now as I listen to you speak. And you've mentioned before about how families of the hijackers are owed apologies. You've said that in other instances, not necessarily here on this show. But have the families, and I legitimately don't know, so I'm asking you, have the families of these hijackers ever spoken to the media? Like, in the United States, we had an arsonist in Seattle, and it took the police a while to catch him. When they finally caught him, the family came out and apologized to everybody and said, our prayers are with the victims, we didn't know. Families speak out a lot of times when somebody is accused and convicted of a crime. Have there been any words from the supposed hijackers that died on September 11th, family members?
Yes, but you have to take into consideration in which countries these people live. We have the alleged hijackers came from Saudi Arabia, the Emirates, Lebanon, and Egypt. Okay. In all of these countries, except maybe Lebanon, families of these people would have to be very, very cautious what they're saying, what they're doing. These are not democracies. These families may even feel that their best way is to lie down, not to say a word. I know, however, that the family of Ziad Jarrah, who was accused to have piloted United Airlines 93, his family has clearly said that they don't believe that he did it. But at one point, they stopped asking questions, and I suppose that they have been threatened or coerced or somehow not to speak up. I don't know. I can only say that I had contact with the family of the Ziad Jarrah in Lebanon. And they were very happy to hear that I don't believe in his participation. When I say I don't believe, I am absolutely certain that he did not participate in this crime. However, the family, after a couple of phone calls, stopped contact with me. And I just suspect that they have been threatened not to talk to me. I cannot tell you more. I only know that it is very difficult for a family of a person who is considered one of the worst criminals to speak up and demand or say, okay, I want proof. If you see, they are not rich people. They are not people in power. They are very, very cautious about their own security. We cannot draw any conclusion from that.
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of complex things that go into human decision-making as well. I mean, it could very well be that they've already experienced having a spotlight thrown on their family back in 2001 when their loved one was accused of this and seen as this monster that did this crime, that if they have any doubts about it, it would throw a big spotlight on them again and a lot of criticism, and they may feel that it doesn't matter, he's dead, it's over, and that speaking out might not accomplish anything. So,
but this is, I'm sorry to interrupt you, this is basically irrelevant for what right. I'm talking here. It's irrelevant. I'm talking about the American people. American people have accepted that the government attacked one of the poorest countries in the world, Afghanistan, without any proof of anything. This is itself an indictment of the American people. Nobody went on the street to protest this act of aggression. Nobody. And Afghanistan is still occupied by Americans. Now, I'm talking about here a country which has never attacked the United States, never done anything wrong to Americans. And the 9/11 truth movement, with all my respect, has never said a word to protect Afghanistan and to say the war in Afghanistan was illegal and criminal under international law, which it was. It was an act of aggression, a pure aggression, which is one of the crimes under the International Court of Criminal Court. Now, what I mean here is that the 9/11 Truth Movement doing very good job by focusing on the forensic and on the World Trade Center is all very, very good. Nothing bad about that. But it is extremely limited politically. And for us, for the people in Afghanistan, who are the victims of the United States, the real victims, they cannot consider the 9/11 Truth Movement as an ally. They couldn't care less about that movement, because that movement has never done anything to protect the Afghan people or to denounce the act of aggression committed in their name by the United States government. And here there is a failure. I find a very large failure of that movement. So the movement should, in fact, be on the avant-garde in protecting and upholding the rights of the people of Afghanistan to the truth, to justice, and to compensation.
Now, I want to make sure we get into some of these deeper concepts that you've talked about. You've commented on how the truth movement should move from a defensive posture to a more offensive one. I think you've touched on that already. So if there's anything else that you'd like to add to that, but you've also talked about the revolutionary potential of 9/11 and the failure of academia and the left. And most people in this country would think the left would be all over this. That's the default position, and a lot of people would say, oh, there were so many people who hated Bush. Wouldn't they be talking about this and protesting about it if it were true? So please address that.
Well, when I'm talking about changing the defensive to the offensive position of the 9/11 Truth Movement, I mean the following. When the 9/11 Truth Movement has has presented itself as an alternative voice, to the official one. This position is untenable, in my opinion. There is no alternative position. There is only one, which is the truth. The government position is not tenable itself. The government position is basically a huge lie. And this lie can be easily shown by the fact that the American government is accusing people who are innocents, who have never come near these planes. So, when we have a government which is completely lying, we have a different... the 9/11 truth movement is basically carrying out modestly, let's put it this way, modestly, the flag of truth. But the 9/11 truth movement has today a very strong position by accusing the defamators, those who are peddling the guilt of Muslims in 9/11, are defamators, are endangering democracy, are contributing to wars, and these people should be condemned and denounced as dangerous for democracy. So all journalists and all authors and all politicians who just open their mouths calling 9/11 accusing Muslims or these 9/11 hijackers, so-called, of carrying out this mass murder, all these people should be accused for lying to the public, for inciting racism, and for contributing to wars. They should be denounced each time that anybody says such a thing. He should be hounded by the 9/11 movement, hounded in public. The people have no right to say such a thing in a democracy, in a civilized country. Nobody has the right to accuse Mohammed Atta or Osama bin Laden for 9/11. Nobody. There is no basis for this accusation. It is shameful to say that, and anybody who is doing it should feel the heat. And the 9/11 movement has now facts. There has now a good basis to go on the offensive and hound all these shameful and dangerous journalists and authors who have kept the United States, who have reduced the name of the United States to dirt, who made the United States a hateful subject in the world. These journalists deserve really a censure.
Well, we've got a major problem here in this country and in other countries too, because it goes on in Great Britain, and it goes on in France, the demonization of anybody that even talks about this issue, trying to stifle discussion of what is just science and common sense in our case, taking on the issue of the Twin Towers and Building 7. And I feel that when this does come out, there will be sociology classes that focus on this. There will be hearings to discuss what went on in this country. The problem is there's so many people that are part of this, whether they know it or not, echoing these same talking points. It's hard to wrap your mind around. But we certainly got a lot of work to do here in this movement. First, just getting the public to understand what really went on. Most people are so intellectually lazy, they don't even want to think about it. Even if they think we have a point. I've heard that so many times. Yeah, you have a point, but I just don't want to think about it. I mean, this is how things like 9/11 are allowed to happen, is through apathy and lack of interest.
I assure you, your view, what you're saying is applicable to many, many, many people in the United States. It's clear. It's the same thing here. My call goes basically more to those who have been already working for years in the 9/11 movement and who are doing diligent and good work, but have had a blind spot regarding international law, the act of aggression, and all what I was mentioning. These are really blind spots. And the 9/11 truth movement has been too much focused on, in my opinion, on a very narrow focus. instead of basically trying to engage with the peace movement against war and engage with the human rights movement because of these accusations and so on. So there are a lot of possibilities of engaging with a wider circle in the society, United States society, to take the 9/11 truth movement to the streets and to the general political struggle.
Right, and it's very difficult when you're the minority in a nation. It's very difficult to get others on board to even look at it to begin with. It's just a huge problem. All these things should be getting done, definitely. We should be over this issue by now. I mean, in my view, it's such a simple common sense conclusion to come to when you look at all the evidence that we present alone on the World Trade Center. That's enough to open up the whole thing over and over again. Now, part of what we face, of course, and individually and as groups, is backlash. And our last couple minutes here, I'd just like to know for you personally, with all of your outspoken activities on September 11th and on other issues too, what kind of backlash have you faced?
Well, backlash, I did not have any backlash. In fact, this is the opposition. I only have received extremely good reviews by readers of my books. I never saw any critique of my book, no backlash, nothing. The only response to my books is basically silence, because there is no way of addressing, there is no way to criticize my books. Nobody is able to criticize my books. This is a problem. And I was even asking people, academics, to tear into pieces my book through a critique, but they wouldn't take the time to do that. So basically, where the problem is far more silence and not a pathological will not to know the facts, which is basically a psychological pathology. So basically, we are dealing here not with fact, with the problem of facts. We are problem with a social and public pathology, which is basically eating into the society, into our civilization, because when an entire nation is putting its head into the sand, well, where are we going to go? So we have a very big problem. It's not my personal problem. I don't have any personal problem. And everybody who is an open-minded person usually says about my books that they are absolutely fantastic. But you see, this is not a question of me trying to be famous. It's not that. It's a question of trying to see how we're going to sanitize society in which the majority of people do not want the truth. And this is a big problem. So I don't know exactly where we have to begin, but I believe that we have to begin with people who have some intellectual capacity to understand and some sense of responsibility for society. And these are the people who should be, in fact, leading that work. So I cannot tell you exactly how to do it, but I try to do it in my own circles here and all over the world. I have contact in different countries. I was in Pakistan in April and met there wonderful people who are also interested in these things. So there are people all over, but we have to understand that the people who are ready to speak up to truth, to speak up close to power, are quite few. And this is unfortunately the case in every generation. But I just urge people to really think independently and give my books the benefit of the doubt, read them, and if you have a critique, please let me know, because I am just interested in the peace, in the truth. And in any case, if you have further information, please do send it to me. But I'm doing that all for the sake of myself and, of course, of society. And I really wish the American people to have a better country, better leadership than they have.
Well, it's only by doing the actions that many people, including yourself in the movement, have done that we can take that first step. And the expression goes, a journey of 1,000 miles starts with one step. So we've all got to take that step together. The new book coming out this spring is The Betrayal of America, Revisiting the 9/11 Evidence. I wish you luck with it, and thank you so much for coming on 9/11 Freefall today. This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. It's also on every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Saying have a great week, and good luck. This program is on every Thursday night on No Lies Radio at 10 o'clock Eastern, 7 o'clock Pacific. It's also on every other Sunday night on BBS Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can also keep track of the archives by going to 911freefall.com. This is Andy Steele. Have a great week. Good luck.